Your mics are live.
Okay, let's get this meeting going. Call to order the Planning and Zoning Commission meeting of January 18th, 2018. And roll call, Ms. Anderson is excused. Mr. Morehouse, I understand, has just resigned without attending a meeting. Mr. Subi?
Here.
Ms. Piranha?
Here.
Mr. McFarland?
Here.
Mr. Pollak?
Here.
Okay, and Chair is here, Mark Ebel. So, call to the public, these are for anybody who would like to speak on behalf of an item that's not on the agenda tonight. Mr. Dunn?
I'm Douglas Dunn, member of the City Council, and liaison, of course, to the Planning and Zoning Commission. I just wanted to indicate that the City Council has established a work session, which will be this coming Tuesday, the 23rd at 5 p.m., to discuss further the alternative lodging parks proposal that you had submitted to us at the meeting previous. There was a desire to discuss further and study that proposal. Also, at that time, I suggested that we delete the exclusion of historic districts from the areas in which this alternative lodging park could be located with a special use permit. And so it would be community-wide, and the Ward 2 representatives, City Council representatives, immediately endorsed that idea. We looked at, you know, I presented a couple of places in terms of where that might fit, and so I think there's an interest in discussing further the whole concept of the, you know, the small house, the mini house concept. This meeting is originally proposed as a joint meeting between you and the City Council, and I don't know for sure where that's been agendized as such, but anyway, I'm wanting to extend an invitation to you all to participate in that meeting this coming Tuesday, and certainly Mark and was at present at our City Council meeting and made an excellent presentation in support of the alternative lodging park, and so I appreciate that. The other recommendations you made to us have moved forward and were formally adopted at the meeting last Tuesday. But anyway, there was a desire to have further discussion. I think there's a feeling that this is that the city is imposing on trailer parks on residential areas, and I don't know if there's a full understanding of what a special use permit is, and this will be an opportunity to discuss further of that. I'm confident that's going to move forward, but anyway, that is, I want to invite you to that meeting.
And that's going to be here, Doug?
It will be here at 5. So it'll be a special meeting, I think it's 5:05 on the Tuesday, the 23rd of January.
And one other question, Doug. The part of the motion for the, apart from the definition of alternative lodging parks, there was an amendment to amend the zoning regs about allowing manufactured homes and mobile homes back into the RM zoning district.
Correct. And that's still a part of that?
That's still part of that.
Right.
I've never understood why we put those two together and why they weren't just two separate amendments.
Certainly when I addressed it at the meeting, I said there are actually two issues here and that we need to discuss separately. And it didn't seem that no one spoke specifically on that issue. There were people who spoke and who have contacted me, again, feeling that there's a fear that we're imposing trailer parks on neighborhoods, and of course, not understanding the special use permit and the process you would go through and able to have an alternative lodging park anywhere. But anyway, I think we are going to be talking about making this applicable community-wide. I raise the question as to what does the word historic districts mean, because certainly Warren also is an historic district, and would that also be excluded? And so that's some of the issues that will be discussed this coming Tuesday.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Doug. Okay, moving on to agenda item 1. This is a public hearing to consider rezoning application 17-03 with a discussion and possible recommendation to the mayor and city council. Paul, Mr. Esparza, you want to give us a rundown on this particular document?
Yes, Vice Chairman Appel and Commissioners, tonight is a request for a rezoning application. It's application number 1703. I do have a location map for you, and let me go ahead and get that. So I'm going to use, I think I'll use this so everyone can see, but let me point this direction. But, so this is the subject parcel that is the request of the rezoning. The dwelling that has been refurbished is this structure right here, and the applicant, Kimberly Blank, would reside in this structure right here. So I know there's some other accessory building, but I just want to, so that we're all clear, Cochise Row, clearly fronts on Cochise Row. But this is the parcel, approximately 0.57 acres. So again, wanted to frame that by showing the property. I don't know if there's any questions on that before I move on from this aerial photograph, but just so we can know where we're talking about here on Cochise Row. So the nature of the request is the applicant is requesting to rezone that parcel from R1 to R3. The R1 district is for one-family residences, and the R3, of course, would be multi-dwellings, apartments, and condominiums. That parcel is located at 54 Cochise Row, and the applicant has renovated the existing dwelling and created 3 bedrooms with in-room private baths. The intended use is to rent the individual rooms for short and long-term rentals. I just wanted to mention, probably more so the long-term is what we should be looking at, because I know short-term, with recent legislation, really local jurisdictions don't have as much to say about those shorter-term regulations. If you're probably familiar with Airbnb rentals, that really, you know, so you really, we really need to focus more on the long-term rental aspect of the request, more so than the short-term. And the applicant would intend to rent these rooms to professionals such as hospital staff at Copper Queen Hospital or Border Patrol agents. So just giving you kind of the breakdown of the zoning district permitted uses, as I mentioned, it's currently zoned R1, as is really all of the adjacent properties in that neighborhood. So again, that gives you the breakdown. A one-family dwelling, excluding mobile homes. I won't read that verbatim, but it does give you an idea of what's permitted. And of course, by introducing R3, that would allow those uses in addition to multiple dwellings, apartment houses, and condominiums. So in as far as staff's analysis of this request, you know, I did look at the general plan and the planning area compliance. So I know that the land use map does identify it as being, it's located within the Warren, historic Warren planning area, and certainly the current zoning, like I mentioned, is R1. So in looking at this, I believe that the rezoning request to R3 would support a couple of the stated goals of that planning area. And I will go, goal 6, support established residential service commercial office and governmental land uses within the Warren area, and objective 6.1, support historic Warren as an established community area. So as far as the compliance with the rezoning procedures, the City of Bisbee does outline what needs to be looked at as far as evaluating a rezoning, but again, does not necessarily specify any criteria. So, you know, staff would recommend that we look at, there's several criteria that I went through to look at this request, but so the applicant did provide the application and a statement of their intent. I would say the proposed use would be compatible with the residential area in Bisbee's general plan. While this is a one-family residential zoning district, when you look at the fact that they want to take the single-family residence and create 3 individual rooms, you know, my thought is that in looking at this, that I don't believe you're going to create a situation where you're going to exceed what the residential count would have been for that structure had you had a, for example, a four-member family. So again, I feel like the impacts aren't. And also to mention that in speaking with the applicant, that this was previously a duplex. So again, it was used as a two-family dwelling in the past. So adequate services and infrastructure, again, the site has all necessary utilities along with adequate parking and access to Cochise Road. As far as the public input, I know that staff did post the property. They did notify adjacent property owners within the 300 feet that's required and did put a legal notice in the Bisbee Observer. And as far as looking at off-site impacts, I don't believe that there's additional impacts that will be realized on the property, considering that if it were occupied by a family, you know, I don't see that there's going to be a lot of additional impacts. The applicant has created off-street parking. And again, I think in looking at this, I don't think there's any outstanding issues. Even looking at the parking regulations, the structure's 1,420 square feet, so by the parking regulations, it would require at least two parking spaces. They would clearly have that in addition to some parking being available on site. As far as public comment, I am aware, and Mr. Ward may be able to speak, I know there was some concern from neighbors with the rezoning and the potential for higher intensity residential uses. And again, I know the applicant has specified very clearly what their intention is to do. And I think when we get to the recommendation and the conditions, I think I can certainly speak to how this might be addressed. So in looking at factors in favor of the approval, approving the rezoning request would still support the residential character of the existing neighborhood. Several Warren planning area goals and policies are fulfilled. The dwelling has been previously occupied as a residential duplex, as I mentioned. Factors against the approval could certainly be this property is surrounded by single-family residential properties, and some R3 permitted uses may be too intense for this neighborhood. So those are some of the considerations that you're definitely going to want to look at. But as far as the overall recommendation conclusion, looking at what they're intending to do, I don't think it's out of character with the neighborhood. I believe that, as I mentioned previously, that you know a family could certainly have you know three cars and four individuals could probably pose the same amount of impacts as what this would be if it were individually rented. And really, there's not, and currently, there's not really another mechanism. I know if you look at, we're changing the zoning, but I really feel that with conditions on this rezoning, and certainly the applicant would need to agree to these as well, but I think that you can minimize any concerns that may be expressed by surrounding property owners. And like I said, I think it's comparable to what you find with a four-member family, and again, it's still compatible with the surrounding area. So staff recommendation would be to recommend a conditional approval to the city council. And I did list a condition. The applicant shall provide the city with a signed acceptance of conditions and a waiver of claims form arising from ARS section 12-1134. And they would do so within 30 days after the city council approves this request. And condition number two, I think this might ease some concerns, but limit the permitted uses under this rezoning request to preclude condominiums and multiple dwellings. I think, and really when you look at the size of the parcel, I mean, there's only so much space, and if you consider, I'm not sure what they would really be able to add to, and I'll go back to the aerial photo, because I was really thinking about, you know, if you look at the size of the parcel, I mean, I think it is somewhat limiting, and, you know, whether or not they could, in fact, try to build additional units. I mean, it's possible, but certainly, I think if you were to limit the condominiums and the multiple dwellings, I think there's only so many opportunities on site. If you consider the setbacks and everything else, would have to be taken into consideration if they were to try to put some other structures on there. But again, looking at the overall, and like I said, I don't believe that it's going to cause any great impact to the overall surrounding neighborhood as this would be moving forward. So I'll go back to the quick staff question. Recommendations, and I'll certainly answer any questions. I know the applicant is here tonight, and I'm sure is happy to answer any questions regarding their request and their intentions for the property.
There's three units in there right now?
It's a three.
It would be considered a three-unit,
yeah,
like apartment.
Yeah, three-unit under one roof. Yeah, three bedrooms with the main living space, but potentially you could have three residents occupying that space.
So would it be feasible for the, that dwelling to be converted into condos? I mean...
You'd have to do a condo plat, and I don't know...
Right, it would be a subdivision process.
Yeah, that'd be a, and I don't know that they would want to, you know, endure that process, but yeah, because, again, if you're going to convey those, that's, they would require a plat.
Okay. Okay, this is a public hearing, but we do have opportunities to ask Mr. Esparza any questions that you might have, and then we'll hear from the applicant. So does anybody have any other questions for Mr. Esparza?
So just to clarify, Paul, it is a three-bedroom unit, so these are not three separate units housed in one structure with separate entrances and the sort. It's one unit with three bedrooms and a shared bath, or a bath with each bedroom?
Each room has an in-room private bath. And honestly, I think it'd be more appropriate for the applicant to speak about the entry points into it, but I understand, you know, potentially you could have three individuals renting one of those rooms.
Okay.
Within that
retention. And I'll save the rest of maybe any of your questions for the applicants when you speak. My other question, follow-up question for you is related to what you referenced at the beginning, which was existing or recent state legislation or law regarding short-term rentals and Airbnb. So I apologize for my ignorance, but could you speak a little more to that in terms of the limiting factor that has with our review or purview or authority?
With that recent legislation, what it's really limiting is local jurisdictions' ability to regulate. I know there's been a lot of concern about folks, you know, especially in areas where, like resort communities, where folks can say, I owned a house up in the White Mountains. I mean, that was very common, you know, that's where I came from, but people were renting out their homes left and right, and again, you could have 20 people show up on a weekend, and you imagine the impacts with the vehicles and the noise and everything else. But again, the legislation has really limited the ability for the jurisdictions to be able to regulate that, especially with the short-term rentals. So basically, you know, you're able to rent. If you had a house, you could rent this out, and there's not much that the local jurisdiction could say about that. I mean, again, there's supposed to be some reasonable impacts that the homeowner would place. I mean, you know, certainly you should make sure you can provide for, you know, ample parking on your property, but again, it's very limiting in what the jurisdiction can do for these short-term rentals.
It doesn't limit the cities from collecting bed taxes, though, does it?
No, and that's one thing that we struggle with where I came from. Again, I mean, they're supposed to be collecting those, you know, those taxes, but again, you know, that's another issue. And how those are collected and remitted back, you know, to the state, but that doesn't preclude them from collecting those taxes, those rental taxes. So.
And this differs from that because it's considered more like an apartment, and there must be a shared kitchen or something.
Yeah, and again, you know, and I haven't been in the structure, but I would certainly allow the applicant to clearly, you know, address that, how that is, the makeup is of that dwelling.
Any other questions for Paul? Okay, then the applicant.
Maybe a question for Joe versus Paul.
Okay.
Just driving down Cochise Row, I mean, I noticed there were at least one, maybe two other buildings, two stories. I didn't look closely to see if there were multiple entrances. So when, you know, as we're reviewing this, you know, with the indication that it's all zoned R1, are we assured that the remainder of that block are all single-family residences? But there aren't existing structures there also already that are multiple residences?
There are.
There are.
The one you're talking about.
So that two-story structure is a multiple residence?
Yes, it is.
Even though it's
a duplex.
Even though it's, all that block is zoned R1.
Right,
yeah.
Probably grandfathered.
Okay.
Pre-existing.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions for Joe or Paul? Okay, then, applicants, if you would like to come up and address us, please. If you could give us your name and address and a little background on what you think how you see using this property. No.
I'm Kenneth Stevens.
And I'm
Kenneth.
Kimberly.
46 Cochise Row, both of us. We bought the house on 46 2 years ago, and at the time, Margot Agar was living next door, and you may have heard of her. She's kind of legendary in Bisbee. At any rate, it was essentially abandoned, and it was stuffed full of junk. She was a hoarder, and we decided when it became available that we wanted to buy it just so that, I don't know, Cochise Row had some bad reputations several years ago, and we were trying to grab a hold of the property because we didn't want meth lab or something to. Anyway, we started developing it and came up with different ideas, and we thought, okay, Airbnb would be one idea. And then we said, well, we don't want the hassle of that, so let's rent it by the week, and we don't want to do that, let's rent it by the month. And then we decided on sort of a multi-use approach for it. So anyway, there's three bedrooms, three independent bathrooms. There's a shared kitchen, shared living room. There's a nice backyard that's shared. What else?
There's a laundry room in the back that also has a toilet room, so when company guests come, they don't have to go into their friend's bedroom. And each bedroom has a key, so gives a lot of your privacy away.
So it's sort of like a boarding house.
It's a boarding, a guest house. We're calling it the guest house. Yes. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, you know, long-term, short-term, three individual renters, family, it could be any of those. We could have two renters in one room, you know, in two rooms, and then a family, you know, or long-term in the other room, and, you know, it doesn't matter. Or one guy wanted to rent it. He was a writer, and he wanted his space and, you know, his copies and so forth. So, I mean, we're open to a variety of things, and talking with Joel during the inspection process and the building process, he thought that getting an R3 would probably be the best way to go about it, because I believe right now we're able to rent up to a 30-day period. But if we want to go beyond a 30-day period, we have to go with a different zoning.
The other thing is, having lived here several years, I realize how limited rental spaces are for people. And I also listen to news and watch all the
Kim.
Professional
use the microphone.
The middle class isn't going to be able to afford houses in the future. So I think we just need to be proactive in different ideas about having living spaces available. So
just for clarity, why isn't this considered, why wouldn't this fall under that statute that's prohibiting us from regulating short-term rentals?
And remember, as I mentioned, you know, we cannot emphasize the short term, but I think it's the long term, because once you exceed the 30 days, then it's considered long term rental.
Okay.
That's really the threshold.
Okay. So, and that may occur at that property.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you folks live right next door to it.
Yes.
Is that the old Eats house? That
yes. Yes.
I know that house.
Yes.
Got it from my friend, I think, the Cohens, Steve Cohen.
Yeah.
Yes.
Played music in that house quite a bit.
Right.
Huh? Anybody have any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Does it meet all of the ADA compliance?
We have a wheelchair accessible bathroom or restroom, shower.
Okay.
I don't know that it meets every ADA requirement, but it is, we call it ADA friendly.
Got it. Thank
you. We reconfigured the whole interior of the house. And purposely did not put a hallway in it, so that we were thinking people with wheelchairs or walkers, a huge part of the population, especially travelers, have walkers. And there's an entry to the two back bedrooms that has a wide door way to go in and a foyer that's large, and that's the one bedroom that you would go into that would accommodate someone with a wheelchair. So we tried to help with that, but it's not completely ADA.
Well, it may be.
Well, it may be, but that wasn't our intent.
Well, it was to make it as ADA compliant as we could within reason.
Yeah, within reason.
Or, you know, without going through researching and going through all the codes and everything. You know, we have all kinds of grab bars and handicap mm-hmm. accessible shower things and shower pan without a curve, you know, you just roll right into it. The turning radius is is, you know, it's correct and all, you know, and, but whether every single light switch is exactly the height, I don't know, because when we were building it, we got concrete walls, and sometimes there's limited space we can actually put a light switch. But, you know, where it made sense, I said, okay, you know, we want to put these at 36 rather than 42, because it's, you know, it's a, we want to try to make it ADA friendly. And plus we had Mitch as an electrician, so.
So you were conscientious.
Yeah. Well, the entrance to the house has one step, and there are no steps in the house. So, I mean, when I first moved here, that was my big question. Why aren't there wheelchair-accessible housing, I mean, short-term housing for visitors? And was surprised to find how limited that is. So I feel fortunate that this property is on such a level space that we were able to think along those terms. So.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Hey. Yes.
Completely. The kitchen as well.
Can you tell me the dimensions of the bedrooms?
They're roughly 11 by 11.
And then
one of them's a little bit bigger, but that's basically what they are.
And then the each bedroom, when you're in the bedroom, there's a door. You walk into your own private bathroom, and the bathroom is 6 by 7.
Thank you. Back when this was advertised the first time, or notice went out, I did have a neighbor, one of your neighbors, call me and had some concerns about the use of the property and what might happen to it. And have you had any conversations or discussions with any of your neighbors there about what you were, you know, intending to do?
Well, you're talking about Nancy, I believe. I know. No. You can't say. We have, yes.
Okay. Because we just received notice of the public hearing on Monday, and this is supposed to go out, isn't it 10 days notice?
They got weeks notice on that, I believe. There's
okay. Even though we received the notice this, like, 3 days ago.
Yeah. They all got, everybody got theirs sent out well within the limits of what we have. I think it was 2 weeks prior at least. And I can answer about the neighborhood with concerns. That the neighbors' concerns are alleviated by what Paul is proposing as these conditions for rezoning, especially number 2.
So that it, they were concerned it might be turned into condos or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and that just doesn't sound practical for that kind of parcel. That would involve a whole subdivision process.
We want 17 stories, maybe.
Yeah.
Plus, we want to live next to this building. We don't want...
Right.
Yeah, no.
Okay. And then once it was condos, it would be out of your control anyway. I mean, essentially.
Yes.
Unless you were the property manager for the condos. Or, but anyway.
You can make timeshares.
Any other questions for the applicants? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, this is a public hearing. I'll open the public hearing. Seeing nobody, I'll close the public hearing and ask staff for their recommendation. Unless, we'll ask for a recommendation and then we'll have discussion on the recommendation.
All right. So, commissioners, let me get back to the recommendation. So staff does recommend consideration of the request for rezoning from R1 to R3 to the City Council based on the analysis of the recommendation of conditional approval subject to the following conditions. As I mentioned, the applicant will provide the city with a signed acceptance of conditions and waivers of claims form. And the second condition, limit the permitted uses under this rezoning request to preclude condominiums and multiple dwellings.
Okay. Any other discussion about the recommendation or proposal? Okay, then I'll entertain a motion.
I'll motion that the P&Z Commission recommend the Mayor or Council of the City of Bisbee approve this application with the conditions of rezoning that have been recommended in the staff report.
Okay. Do I have a second?
I can second that.
Okay. I'll do a roll call vote. Mr. Subi?
Aye.
Ms. Carano?
Aye.
Mr. McPartland?
Aye.
Mr. Pollack?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. It's unanimous. Okay. All right. Thank you. Moving on to agenda item number two. Discussion and possible recommendation to the mayor and city council to amend the zoning code article 3.5.5 of the city of Bisbee. This is also a public hearing and call for a staff report.
Our design review board has been working for a number of, they worked for a number of months on getting the language that they wanted for this proposed amendment, because there was, they were wanting to define closer what would be allowable when it comes to demolitions within the historic district. And this is this is what they were proposing. And I agree with what they're proposing. I think it's a reasonable middle of the road approach.
That's it. Can you give us a little more detail about what's being proposed here in terms of the changes?
Okay.
I mean, what are the substantive changes that are occurring here in terms of getting a demolition permit?
They've struck the retention of the structure would be cause undue financial hardship to the owner, because that's a nebulous kind. They said that is a nebulous. They figured that was a nebulous kind of a statement, because everybody's, you know, you could use that as the example, but it wasn't a fair enough way of. Am I saying that right, Michael?
Well, I serve as DRB chair, and this is something we took on about six, seven months ago, because we didn't have a fair, transparent, and consistent minimum standard for reviewing demolition requests, and the one provision that we proposed striking was one that at least the majority of commission members did not feel comfortable creating a way to verify financial hardship. So we discussed that quite thoroughly, and the general consensus was going down the slippery slope of determining what financial hardship is relative to the structure and to the owner of the building would either require the city to take on more responsibility to gather that information and keep it confidential, because that was one of the concerns, how do you keep that confidential? And it wasn't appropriate for the commission members to be looking at the specific financial or income status of the applicant. So we determined there were other ways we could address the feasibility of rehabilitation by focusing on the other provision, which is to require a certified or licensed contractor to provide an evaluation of the structure and what cost would be incurred to try to rehabilitate the structure to get at what's feasible.
And then they had added the part about the building inspector being able to order immediate demolition of a building that was endangering public health and safety.
Yeah.
And then you'll see number C, which is demolition by neglect. That entire section was proposed to be added to the existing.
Okay. I had some heartburn, as I expressed to the city attorney, about the language contradicting itself within the regulations here. You know, the very first paragraph of 3.5.5 says, no permit shall be issued by the building inspector until DRB approval. But then further down it says, the building inspector can go ahead and order a demolition without DRB approval. That's pretty contradictory. So the city attorney suggested adding in some very simple language in the very first paragraph that says, and I'm suggesting this as an amendment to what we're looking at tonight, except as provided in 3.5.5A1, in front of that sentence here, in the very first paragraph that says, no permit shall be issued by the building inspector until DRB approval.
I think that makes sense, and although I need to represent the majority of the DRB, there are certain points that I was concerned about in terms of our final proposal, and this is one of them, so yes, I think that makes sense.
And I had proposed changing one of those words. I think I told you guys when I sent this out, the part that was in green I proposed, but it's because it said he may order the immediate demolition there in number one, and I thought that was too exclusive. I didn't change it to the building inspector, so if we had a woman building inspector, it would fit anybody, any place.
Joe, can I, one other thing I need to bring up just in reviewing the, this proposed language, as I recollect as chair, we also included ensuring that the DRB committee members or commission members would have access to inspect the structure as feasible with an application for demolition, because that had been another issue that had come up previously. And we wanted to ensure that that was codified so that an owner could not, for example, say, I'm applying to demolish this building, and no, you cannot look at it or inspect it or see the interior of the structure. You can just go by the pictures that were presented to you at the meeting, which several members expressed concern about, because anyone can take a picture and present something a certain way. We wanted to also be able to have the option to inspect the structure, interior or exterior, in a demolition application, and I didn't see this in the final language. I was surprised.
So do you have a suggestion on the language that could go in here somewhere that would address that?
I suggest something along the lines of DRB commission members and or building inspector reserve the right to have access to the structure to inspect it when a demolition application is initiated.
And where would that go, Michael?
You tell me what would be the best, where would be the best place for that to be.
I think probably the first paragraph, the very first 3.5.5, before you get into the approval provisions there.
I'm agreeable to that.
For permit approval, the applicant must show that preserving the building is not physically and or economically feasible, and maybe right after that, the very end, last sentence, plug in your particular wording. Can you, you want to give that to Joe one more time so he has that?
It's just something like, so just to give me the last line of that paragraph you just read, if you would.
For permit approval, the applicant must show that preserving the building is not physically and or economically feasible.
The DRB reserves the right to gain access to the structure to inspect it in line with the demolition application.
Do you have those, can you, you got that?
I got that. I don't remember that being in the wording that was passed by the design review board, Michael, but I think that's a really good item that should be in there.
I know it's, we certainly discussed it, and we left it to one commission member to provide that final language to you. So that's, again, why I'm surprised I don't see it here, but want to ensure that based on my recollection of our discussion and the majority of the group's point of view and what we voted on, that that's also, this is meant to include that.
Yeah.
And that on top of the language I suggest, that actually Britt has suggested, except as provided in 3.5.5A1, that would go right into the very beginning of the second sentence of the paragraph, right leading into no permit shall be issued by the building inspector until DRB approval. You see that place?
Yep.
Okay. So you got those?
I got it. It's all recorded.
Okay. Great. So, any other discussion or questions about this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. The DRB, I understand, is to give us their, what do you call it, their recommendations on the aesthetics of the exterior of a house. But in the DRB process, we're giving them access to look at more than just the outside of the house, and they have a say on the construction standards of a house.
Not the construction standards, but the DRB, as I understood it, and it's in how it was instituted or constituted, was more of a preservation-based organization. So it wasn't really just the aesthetics, but the aesthetics tied into the historic relevance of the historic district, linked to having a landmark historic district and how you maintain that and preserve it. So the demolition responsibility is related to preserving the historic district, its character, its scale, and those structures deemed historic or contributing structures. So when someone initiates a demolition application, the DRB has to be able to assess with informed input, with a contractor's assessment based on this proposal, if the structure is indeed habitable, redeemable, or not, to consider the demolition request, because we're removing an historic structure potentially from the historic district.
Contributing structure.
Yes.
And Noah, I'd like to make, I'd like to bring your attention to number four. There, that was always there. that having to do with the, if we, they're going to decide whether the offset, how would they do that if they couldn't get into the house? And they have been, you know, looking at the inside of houses that we were going to, that were being proposed for demolition.
Okay. This is a public hearing. Did you want to have any, you have any other questions for Joe or Michael?
Not really. I guess I'm just questioning the whole system now, but.
And this was proposed prior to Brett's.
No, I understand.
Contentious.
Well, I understand. I didn't,
a lot of contention.
I didn't realize that the DRB had that authorized that, you know, right. I didn't know that it was more than an aesthetic board, you know, that they, you know, and it just comes down to personal opinion again, I feel like, with these boards and recommendations, because you can look at a dilapidated falling down structure and say it's historic because it looks extremely old, and I think different board members, different panel members are going to have different thoughts on whether that can be saved or not, and then I guess it just comes down to a vote whether how many people agree that that one can be saved or not. And then the homeowner is that's kind of the end of that.
Well, just to respond, Nolan, in line with understanding some of the context of the recent demolition request that came before DRB, a contributing structure isn't an opinion. That's something that's actually evaluated, submitted to SHPO, and they make the final decision and sign off as to whether or not that building constitutes a contributing structure or not. So, you know, we have previously limited ourselves as a commission to, you know, does it have a contributing structure designation? If it doesn't and there's a demolition request for it, we have approved demolition requests for a small number of structures over the last 3 years since I've been on the DRB, both as chair and previously as a member. Some of those were identified as contributing structures, but the commission as a whole agreed they were essentially too far gone, and the owner showed absolutely no interest as well in wanting to rehabilitate the structure. This most recent case is probably the first time we've had an application where there was a difference of opinion, but what it highlighted to me, having served in that commission, was that our existing guidelines allowed us to do whatever we wanted. That was my concern, and the concern of some other commission members was our existing process, as it stated, essentially allows a case-by-case review for every demolition request, so there's no minimum floor established for what we ask for. We could say yes to you, no to him, yes to someone else, and essentially defend it as being on a case-by-case basis. So this at least raises the standard a little to require a licensed contractor to provide an assessment, which was not in our prior language, to do away with the whole financial hardship language, which was in our current language, which no one has an appetite to want to take on in the commission, because all that gets into income qualification, income standards. So we talk long and hard about how do we still address what's feasible without going down the income path or an income documentation path of the owner. So to my mind, this at least raises the standard a little for consistency. So you or someone else has a point to argue to say, well, it's not a contributing structure, or here are the reasonable assessments that have been done by licensed contractors and documented and submitted to the commission for review. There's something logical and factual to argue with versus our existing process.
If you should be deemed arbitrary and capricious.
At its worst, it is structurally set up to that it could be arbitrary and capricious. We're just fortunate, I would say, that we've had enough commission members of integrity to want to make sure that is not what it becomes, but it easily could become that. I think there was also a recognition that in the current economic climate, compared to when these demolition, the revisions to the demolition process were promulgated by DRB some years ago, 2004, 2005, I don't remember exactly. This process has gone through several iterations. So if you go two iterations back from the current one we're proposing and the one that's in effect, the iteration before that was highly prescriptive, put a tremendous burden on the owner of the property to be able to demolish the structure. It essentially made it nearly impossible for a structure in the historic district to be torn down. So that was the prior two iterations passed. The current iteration went almost to the other extreme of it's all up to us case by case, except we put a financial hardship reference in that no one has really wants to look at or actually collect any data on. So then it's simply the applicant saying, yes, it's a financial hardship for me. That has no substance or factual basis to it. So it kind of misleads the applicant to think they have to go down a certain path that we're not even documenting or in any way confirming. So this was an attempt by the DRB to not go back to the most extreme standard, which we had two iterations back, but to have at least some minimum standards that guided the applicant. Here's at the very least what we need to consider your application. We could still say no, we could say yes, but at the minimum, we've collected some factual information we can make a decision on. And I think that was what the entire DRB, so it was a unanimous vote as I remember it, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but it was something the entire DRB, which has a variety of opinions, said they could all live with. It didn't seem overly regulatory, but not have the potential for arbitrary and capricious responses or decisions from us. If that provides just some context.
I still have a question about the building inspector may order the immediate demolition of the building and then notify the DRB of his decision. I'm a little confused on the sequence of this. So if a property owner came up to you and says, I want to demolish this building, and you determine, the building inspector determines that it's a hazard to public safety, and you order the immediate demolition of the building in accord with the charge to protect public safety and health, et cetera, they tear it down and then you notify DRB, or do you still have to go to DRB before anybody does anything to the building?
Go ahead, Mark. I'd kind of like to respond because it kind of puts Joe on the spot since he didn't actually come up with this part of the proposal. But in discussion with him, what we wanted to do was to acknowledge that there's already an administrative authority we give the building inspector, the DRB does, right, for certain obvious, clear situations that conform with DRB guidelines. So what we also wanted to maintain and continue was to ensure that the building inspector had the administrative oversight if something was a serious health hazard, clearly met existing zoning code violations, that it was a true and present hazard for, you know, in that neighborhood, to have that authority to do that. It wasn't intended, the context was not, Joe can just go on and start, you know, condemning buildings left and right. It was to say, if it's a clear, compelling, urgent issue, we want you to have the authority to act, you know, but we're extending that in the kind of trust contextual relationship that the DRB has with the building inspector, so we don't get in the way of something that's urgent and needs to be addressed, but still maintain a process that has integrity for the potential demolition of historic structures.
So the approval for that would be implicit by the DRB?
Yes.
Because, so he decides that it is a public safety and health hazard, and he says, yeah, it should be torn down. Does he have to come to you, to the DRB, for the final approval of that, or is it implicit?
It's implicit. In the administration.
He doesn't have to meet with you guys. He
does need to provide us the information of that demolition approval.
Right.
So we did institute a process starting this past month where any administrative approvals that are made by the building inspector are provided at the end of our agenda for review. So there's an open dialogue. We see what he's approving, so we see that it's in concert with the DRB guidelines as we understand them as a commission, so that if there's any questions we have the opportunity to bring those questions to him at that point. But it was in that kind of context that already exists, mm-hmm, where it's clear, there's no controversy, the zoning codes clearly indicate this building meets the conditions for demolition, so there's existing code guidance.
Yeah.
It's not he's just winging it.
Right.
But that he has that authority to do that in those rare cases when that comes up.
And I don't think that would be something, Mark, that somebody would be applying for. I think that would be something that would be imposed on a property owner, that they would have to tear it down because when it gets to the point where it's a hazard of falling down, it's a hazard to health and safety,
right,
to life and safety. It's not something that in that point that you're having people apply for, this is something that's being imposed on them.
So when you order the immediate demolition of the building, who are you ordering? The property owner?
The property owner.
And if they don't, and if they don't respond?
If they don't respond, it goes to the city attorney. I have never had to do that.
So again, we saw this as a rare situation that may occur. We wanted to anticipate it and make clear that he has that authority in those rare, extreme, clear cases to use that administrative authority he's already using to approve certain windows going into historic buildings that clearly meet the DRB guidelines. So there's no issue that it's, there's no point of view, reasonable point of view that would say this is well outside or might have some controversy to it. It's clear, unambiguous. He has that authority based on the clear guidelines that exist.
I just have a problem with where that, I agree. I mean, I'm not contending that it shouldn't be in here. I just, the structure of the language in here and where it is confusing. Because it follows this sentence that says the design review board may recommend approval of a demolition or relocation permit if any of the following conditions exist. And then goes on to say that Joe, or the building inspector, has the authority to order the immediate demolition of a building. They seem...
Maybe what we need to do, and if you're agreeable to this to address the concern, is modify that portion of the language to indicate where a clear safety health hazard per zoning code exists. So there's something tying why he would have that, gives a context for why he would have that authority and why the DRB of all groups would be affirming that authority that he has.
We have two separate building codes that address the situation. There's the 1997, it's the code for the abatement of dangerous buildings, as well as we have the 2012 property maintenance code, international property maintenance code, and both of them have our manuals for what is allowed and when it's allowed for the to order the demolition of buildings is amongst the other.
So just for a housekeeping here, could I suggest one editing change here? And it's just a matter of moving some words. It's not changing the meaning or anything. It's just moving them to make it clear.
Yeah.
That whole number one, A1, instead of using Britt's language of except as provided. So there's no ambiguity about whether the DRB has to approve what you're doing, you know, when you're exercising your authority. Can we just take out A1 altogether and put it in the introductory paragraph? Second sentence where it says, no permit shall be issued by the building inspector until DRB approval, with the exception of if a structure is judged by the building inspector, blah, 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 blah. You see what I'm saying? Or let me see. No permit shall be issued by the building with the, easy fix. Right after the sentence, no permit shall be issued by the building inspector until DRB approval, period, insert the sentence, however, and then put in all of number one. And then just take that number one out from underneath A.
Sure.
You see that?
Yeah.
That way you're taking that ambiguity out of the sentence, the way it's written in here. Because there's some ambiguity with where it's placed. So then you just have to renumber the other ones, and I think it'll all be pretty straightforward from there.
Yeah, this is all worded by a member of the design review board.
So, you know, all the wording about, you know, when the building inspector has authority to do this and all that is up in the introductory paragraph, right after the second sentence that says, so this would be the third sentence now in the introductory paragraph. So just scratch that, except as provided that Britt suggested, and can keep the second sentence as it is. No permit shall be issued, blah, 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 and then follow that sentence with, however, if a structure is judged by the building inspector, take out the word the and put in the word if a structure is judged by the building inspector to be a hazard to public safety, the building inspector may order the immediate demolition of the building in accord with his charge, blah, 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 blah.
Perfect.
Okay. I feel much better about it being a wordy one here.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it.
Okay, this is a public hearing. Opening up the public hearing. Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. And unless we have any other discussion about this, I'll ask for a motion. And then, there are C's. There's a C and a D.
I'll call that
E.
C is in the process to prevent and abate conditions deemed demolition by neglect, and D, require owners seeking DRB demolition approval to consult design and construction professionals to verify that the rehabilitation is not feasible in their specific instance.
And E. Very good. Do I have a second?
I second that.
Okay. Roll call. Okay. Mr. Pollack?
Aye.
Mr. Subi?
Aye.
Ms. Verana?
Aye.
Mr. McPartland?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. It's unanimous. I want to thank Michael for all the work that you guys did in the DRB to bring this to us.
I feel like we all just redid a good deal of the work here, so I'm going to thank the P&Z Commission and the Chair for helping us be more clear in our intention.
Okay. Agenda item 3 for discussion and possible action, creation of a list of agenda items that the Commission will prioritize for action in 2018. I know we're supposed to do this at the beginning of every year. We had a list that we developed last year. Parking was on there. Joe, can you remind us of some of the things that we had on our list? Do you have an idea of what it was you said last year? And just wonder if we could check some of those things off.
I didn't bring it with me.
Okay. I know that parking is still high on our agenda. And I do have, I have a professor, Christina, let's see here, let me pull up her information. There's a professor at the University of Arizona that I spoke with last week. And she is very interested in Professor Christina Kearns. She's got a class of graduate students. Some of them are engineering students. Some of them are planning students. They're all graduate level. And she and I discussed at length a way to kind of develop this as our parking dilemma in the historic district as a class project. And so. And that is for this semester that just is going to start here, I think, next week at the university. So that will entail her bringing the class down. And I've provided her the transportation study and the inventory of parking spaces that Torin Sato did, our sustainability intern that we had last year or 2 years ago, and gave her a pretty good background on our park and our most recent amendments to the zoning regs regarding exempting parking for existing structures, et cetera. And so I provided her with a ton of information. And I think her class has got a lot of resources to chew on. And then if they were to come down and do a field trip, then they would get a pretty good idea of what our parking situation looks like in the historic district. And then what I've asked them to do is to formulate some kind of menu of options. I also provided them John Charlie's PowerPoint presentation, which outlined some really nice options for us some years ago that we've never acted on. But to look at what's been done and to see if there's any way they could craft some specific menu options and recommendations for us.
And Chair Pell, the information you provided, does that include the John Charlie information? Does that include that charrette that was done that had proposals either for parking structures in Old Bisbee?
Yes.
As well, okay, thank you.
I provided them the shred as well.
Okay, thank you.
So
So they've got it all, as far as I know, so, or will have it all. She's got it all right now, and how she gets it to her class. Like, God bless them, you know. It's a lot of information to digest. But in the end, by May, we could have a nice report, and it might even be a couple of reports, you know, because her class is kind of small. I think she said there's 8 to 10 people in her class, and she might split them up into teams, and whether they pull their recommendations together or if they provide two different reports to us, that remains to be seen. But anyway, that's one of our agenda items for 2018, I would suggest, the parking issue in the historic district and how to modify the regs or come up with some ideas, other ideas about the historic district. Does anybody else have any other hot topics or burning issues in the regs? Yes.
Well, I guess one, and it was based on what Mr. Sparza provided to us, and again, I apologize for my ignorance in terms of the state legislation that has already been enacted, but given the concerns that I know a number of neighbors have expressed to me just about Airbnb set up throughout Old Bisbee. I know from my previous place that I lived in where Airbnb started essentially, and then there are real structural issues that came up in many of those neighborhoods. Even if our purview or authority is limited by state statute or law, I think we should at least put it on the agenda of something to review about where, what authority we do have, so at least we're clear and we can be clear in our, with our community as well. Because my sense is as density issues continue to come to us, as this one issue was, you know, suggesting as well, there's a density fear of what could it lead to, that we at least can say, here's what we can monitor or create regulation for, and here's where we can.
Well, more importantly, where in the zoning reg, what do we have to amend in the zoning regs to be in compliance with the state statute? That would be my big question.
Okay, that, yeah.
Because there may be things, you know, in our definitions of B&Bs, where we list B&Bs as a special use, we might have to take those out of the matrix now, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Vice Chairman Appel, what we did is, as far as Cochise County regulations, we did amend our bed and breakfast definition. And again, using kind of model language from other jurisdictions. And I did, just for the sake of discussion, I did bring this up to Attorney Hansen about this particular issue, and again, looking at what other jurisdictions. So again, I'll speak with him again about that. And again, if I could, just one more item that Vice Chairman Appel had brought up is House Bill 2365, the wireless facilities in the right-of-way. I did reach out to the city of Sierra Vista. They have already adopted their regulations, but it's like 15 pages long. So Britt was going to take a look at that, and I don't know if, I imagine that it's that length for a reason based on what the state statute requires, but again, we'll have to, you know, in discussion with Britt, determine what's appropriate for the city of Bisbee, so.
Yeah, it'd be great to know what we have to amend in our regs to be in compliance with both of those statutes, and then recommend those amendments to us. So that we don't have to sit here crafting them ourselves. That would be great. Any other zoning, burning issues in our zoning regs that anybody wants to suggest? I mean, it's not like this is the one and only opportunity we have to suggest things to work on. I mean, you always have something to come up every month that, for discussion, as something that we might want to work on. And Joe, please, you know, continue the great job of bringing our attention to these places in the zoning regs that are either contradicting each other or causing some problems for you as the, you know, zoning enforcement officer.
They're always jumping up.
Yeah.
I just see, just being a realtor, it's the number one and number two questions are Airbnb and tiny houses.
Okay.
All day long.
Yeah. So we've got, before the city council, Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, did the city already approve the adoption of the definition of tiny houses? We haven't yet, but that's still part of that definition, of the other definition. So that's really a three-part amendment, isn't it? You know, the definition of alternative lodging parks, the definition of tiny homes, and amending the regs to allow manufactured mobile homes back into the RM zoning districts.
I'll correct myself. I believe the definition of a tiny home is in the international building code standards, and so we did adopt that. So that's, I think there is a definition. I'm a little confused right now, but anyway, there are two.
I believe it's 400 square feet.
I think it's 296.
Yeah, it's smaller than that. Isn't it, Joe?
I believe it's 296.
296.
Yeah.
So do we need to also put that definition of tiny homes into our zoning regs?
Wouldn't hurt. It's a good place for people to look for it.
In the definitions. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's going to come up in the historic district is that there are people that are calling me for the first time ever. I mean, I've been a real estate agent since 2006, full-time in Bisbee since 2014, and I'm getting multiple calls to say the fourth quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year, people have already are seeking out all the remaining buildable parcels. Mm-hmm. So what they're looking at is obviously not building one tiny house, but how many tiny houses can they build on one parcel?
That's a good question. Yeah, the density issue. So that's something we should look at. I would suggest that we put that on our list of looking at density issues of tiny homes on one parcel.
And then along with that, is if the square footage is 296 square feet, so just say that's 300 square feet. So if you do 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, if you do 5 tiny houses, that's 1,500 square feet. Is that 5 different sewer bills, or is that all hooked up to one sewer bill, and since it's one parcel number and there's 5 houses?
Yeah. Well, it also speaks to whether or not somebody's proposing a subdivision of parcels, that, you know, each one would own their individual little piece of that one parcel, and that would entail the subdivision process.
So the person...
Or the multiple family zoning district, like the R3 zoning district that we just approved for these folks here.
Yeah, so I had one call. They were looking at one parcel, and they wanted to build 6 tiny homes on that one parcel.
But how are they going to use those tiny homes? Are they going to be rentals?
Correct.
Then that pulls into our alternative lodging. It is confusing as to whether or not that's going to run afoul of the new state statute about short-term rentals.
Yeah, that's going to have to be looked at because, again, you know, are they short-term or long-term? Because that could make a difference, right?
So. Well, in this particular case, they were looking at short-term.
Short-term.
But when you have multiple units on one parcel that you're renting for short-term, that changes the definition of what you're looking at more like an alternative lodging park. And then they would be compelled to go through special use.
Yeah.
Can't those parcels be broken into their original lots? Because the way that the code is written, it seems like the original lots are very small.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would think there'd be something different about building brand new tiny homes to rent, whether it's long term or short term, as in regards to this. The Arizona legislation for the Airbnbs, that was due to the city, like I know, for example, in Sedona, the city passed a law saying that putting a limit on short-term rentals, using your own house or your rental for an Airbnb for a short-term rental. Mm-hmm. I think there'd be, you'd still have to go through all our zoning regs to be able to build a house,
multiple
houses, or even one, and just be able to say right from the bat, oh, it's going to be a short-term rental. You don't have any authorization on this. That I don't think that can be the case at all. Yeah.
So I think it would be a really good idea if we had some clarification between our residential zoning, and it would also entail a change in your zoning, you know, where R1 zoning is allowing one unit, you know, one house, whether it's 296 square feet or 1,500 square feet on a parcel, on a tax parcel. I don't know how that pertains to lots within a parcel, though, you know, the original town site lots. That's something we need to know from Brit, you know, how our zoning regs apply, how are
how our zoning applies, our residential zoning applies to lots versus parcels. That's a question for the city attorney. Because that could be huge. You know, I've got three lots in my parcel. And does that mean I could put three homes on my parcel?
I think it does. But you'd have to divide them back into their own lots, into their own parcels.
What's that?
But you would have to divide them into their own, each lot into its own parcel.
Really?
Yeah,
I believe so.
Yeah, I think you might have to do like a minor land division. Now, would do each of those lots currently meet the minimum lot size for the zoning district?
If I was going to sell those, yes.
Yeah, if you're going to convey them.
If I was going to sell them, but if they were my, if they were going to be maintained under my ownership, and I was going to rent them out, either a short-term or long-term rentals, that's a different story. So I don't know that I would have to parcel them out. If I wasn't going to sell them, you know, as its own little residential lot, sell it to somebody else. That's a subdivision process. So, you know, it would be helpful if we could have a presentation either by Mr. Esparza or Britt on lots versus parcels and what that means for residential density in Bisbee. And, you know, what are the rules, when did the subdivision rules kick in? And in terms of the tiny homes, another issue that's going to come up is whether they're coming in wheels and staying on wheels, or are they going to be put on a permanent foundation? Because if they come in on wheels, then they're considered a manufactured or mobile home or an RV, something like that. I don't know what we consider them if they come in on wheels, but they're not going to be a site-built single-family residence unless they're put on a permanent foundation.
I think they'll be an RV, not a manufactured home, because there's different standards for that.
Right. They have to go through the ADOT standards to be able to be pulled around on the roads.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they would be considered an RV, and they couldn't be used as a permanent dwelling on a single-family residential lot. But they could in an alternative lodging park, which is why we created that definition.
That is true.
Yeah, so I asked about that with a local lender, just because I'm getting asked so many questions. So if it's brought in, if it's manufactured in Oregon and brought here on wheels, and then they attach it with like a skirt or whatever, even though it came in on wheels, it's still considered
single-family residence.
I think they're for lending purposes, they're going to consider it site-built,
right.
so that people can actually get loans on it.
Yeah, and that makes sense. But we just need to know how many of those can be and put in as site-built homes. Can they only do one per parcel, or can they do one per lot? And so we may have to look at our definition of what a lot is versus a parcel. We do have a definition in the zoning rights for a lot, but how that affects our subdivision process and what that means under the definition of a parcel is another story. So any other topics? Hot topics coming up?
And you know, Mark, one of them that you guys had last year was what became the alternate lodging parks, one of your primary goals, and here, you know, next week they're going to be when there's session on it, so that's the work session, the council, so that hopefully will come to fruition, but that's something you guys worked long and hard on last year.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that we were just trying to address one particular aspect of all these different kinds of residences, mobile homes, manufactured homes, tiny homes, RVs, vintage trailers, travel trailers, park models, you know, and where can we put all those? So that's why we came up with the alternative lodging park.
Yeah, it kind of morphed.
Yeah.
And the other one to consider is containers, where they're using shipping containers. That's another one that's hit Phoenix and...
Yeah.
Going to creep down here pretty soon.
It could, but they're going to run up against the International Building Code when it comes to whether or not they're considered a structure, a residential structure, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's any problems, very few problems with them being out in the county being used as storage containers, but being converted to residential for residential use, then they'd have to in conformance with the International Building Code. So electrical, plumbing, foundations, structure, all that.
It's a rather expensive process.
Yeah. Not to say that it can't be done, but it's going to be a little more arduous for those people who want to do that.
Sure, not going to be historic looking.
No, they're not going to be historic looking. Let's get one of those really old storage units. Okay. Well, if you don't have any more items for the agenda items for next, for action in 2018, we'll move on to agenda item number four. For discussion of possible action, amending the special use permit and rezoning procedures and forms. Okay, we're in the process of updating the rezoning application form. Well, we've done it. I don't know why we're still in the process. It's done. In fact, the applicants that were in here last night used that form, didn't they?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, that form's done. The SUP.
That process is done.
Yeah.
If we could.
Yeah.
In my mind, the only thing that we need to do, so if we could do the same thing to the special use permit.
And use your work that you did on the rezoning form as a template.
Yeah.
Easy enough.
Okay, so that's one thing. And then the second thing under that would be to pull the criteria that we have listed in that form into the zoning reg so that we have some point of reference for.
Okay, so it'll be amended.
Criteria that we evaluate rezonings and special uses. So Paul, is that something you could look into?
I can help with that, yeah.
Thanks. Anybody else have anything having to do with those rezoning and special use applications? And as a way of background for our new commissioners, our rezoning application before was about one page and was pretty too easy to fill out. And it's not that we wanted to create a process that was harder for people to rezone their property, but we needed more substantive information about what they wanted to do and asking them for a site plan and things like that in the rezoning application. And then we also wanted to make the applicant aware, if they're going to rezone their property, these are the criteria by which we're going to evaluate the rezoning. So they knew right up front, when they get out that application and they start filling it out, that they would know ahead of time the kinds of things that our staff would be looking at and recommending to us as to whether or not a rezoning was appropriate in a neighborhood or not. But prior to this time, they had no idea, you know, how we were going to evaluate their rezoning request. They just put in their existing zoning and their proposed rezoning district, their zoning district, proposed zoning district, and handed in their fee and their address, and that was about it. It was pretty simplified, oversimplified in my mind. And so, you know, it may be appropriate for very simple rezoning cases, but when you are going to rezone a property that is proposing a two-story hotel and 80 parking spaces and in a big chunk of the historic district, we need a little bit more information. So that's what compelled us to redo the rezoning application. Okay, if there's no more discussion on agenda item four, we'll move to item five for discussion. The commission will discuss amending Article 7 of the zoning code to limit the use of stationary vehicles as off-site signage. Now, you gave us some examples, Joe, of the county and, was it the city of Sierra Vista?
Yeah. You guys, I don't know if you've been aware of, there's been some vehicles that have been used like that, and there's been a lot of complaints about it. And it kind of put us in a position where we've never been before. People, you know, there's a hotel over near Castle Rock that they had a banner, and I said, you got to take that down. The DRB doesn't allow banners. So they put it on the side of a vehicle, and there's nothing I could do about it, or so I thought. Britt says that there is something I can do about it. But if we can codify that and make it so that it's not a policy, but an actual code in the sign codes,
right,
would be I think a good thing. I brought this before the design review board, and they thought it was more appropriate that it be citywide, and kind of punted it to you guys.
So it's the issue of off-site advertising, really.
Yeah.
Whether it's on a vehicle or a sandwich board sign or.
Yeah. Well, mostly it's about the vehicles-mounted signs. It's like, you know, grass, I was used as an example, say, grass heating and cooling. They've got their name on their vans, but they're out here working on different places.
Right.
They're not using it as off-site. And there's, it's kind of hard to define in a way of when you would say that. And I thought that, that both Cochise County and Sierra Vista had some, had it written pretty well. And so I gave you guys both of those examples as maybe something we can use as a template. But it's your decision whether you want to tackle that or not.
Yeah, I think we should. Yeah. People agree?
I agree, yeah.
Mm-hmm. People are, you know, it's off-site advertising, and people are, you know, taking advantage of that, you know, where they're putting signs up about their business that's not on the property itself. And that can cause property, that can cause problems. And so I would suggest that he ask Paul to, you know, kind of come up with a, some language for us to bat around next month. And if we like it, then we can recommend it to a public hearing for March. That would be an easy one. Okay. Back for commissioner comments. Any other comments? Not a lot tonight. Future agenda items, suggestions, we've already, I think we've suggested some other topics we can look at. Mm-hmm. Any other ones that come to mind since then? All right. You guys have enough to chew on anything for a while?
Yeah.
Paul? Yeah. Paul, we really appreciate your help.
Oh, happy to help out.
It's great to have your input on amendment language, okay. Proposed amendments and things like that. I really appreciate it. So. Okay, with that, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I motion we adjourn.
All right. Thank you. I will be out. I will not be at the meeting in February. I'm going to be out of town.
Okay.
Ms. Anderson will take her
take
rightful spot as chair of this commission.
Oh, okay.